Okay, good morning, everybody. I handed out some notes. I may cover them briefly in the lectures, but I hope you'll find them interesting reading this weekend. There's some notes from my cosmology course, but they include a discussion of the Einstein-Hilbert action and some discussion about fluids, which will actually be complementary to what I do in the lectures. So last time we discussed Einstein's equations, okay, which have to be the most amazing equations in physics. Okay, that on the left-hand side you have geometry, and on the right-hand side you have energy. And so this is these equations describe what, as Wheeler put it, energy causes space to curve, and curvature of space causes matter. Causes energy to move, okay? And these equations describe the relationship between the geometry and the energy. Now, actually, subsequent developments of physics have put more and more of the energy into the geometry. And I was describing to some of you after the end of the last lecture the idea of Kaluza-Klein, where you introduce a fifth dimension of space. So you now have a five-dimensional universe, but the fifth dimension is very tiny, too small to see. So at every point in this room, there's another direction going in the fifth dimension, the fourth dimension of space, curled up in a little circle. And it turns out if you do that, that the five-dimensional Einstein equations include, when you write them as a four-dimensional Einstein equation plus something. The something is the stress energy of the electromagnetic field. Okay, so Maxwell's theory actually emerges out of Einstein's theory in five dimensions. And that's called Kaluza-Klein theory. It's a very interesting idea. And more generally, string theory and M theory are fundamentally geometrical theories. Okay. So the way to think of them is that you have, say, a four-dimensional space-time, or in the case of M theory, a 11-dimensional space-time, and embedded within it are curved spaces of different dimensions, like strings and membranes and five brains and all these geometrical objects. But basically, one could describe this as saying that this term in the Einstein equation tends to disappear as you go to more and more unified theories, but this term is more fundamental. And that's definitely the way unification is going, is that Einstein's theory is, in a sense, the mother of all theories. So now I'm just going to discuss a little bit more about the stress energy tensor. So the right-hand side of Einstein equations, in a sense, this is the uglier part of the equations. Okay, what could be more beautiful than the notion of a curved manifold with curvature? It's so the left-hand side is extremely beautiful. The right-hand side is the kind of ugliness of the real world. We're all made of particles and fields and all kinds of junk. And so let's talk a little bit about the stress energy tensor. Well, its defining properties, it's a symmetric two-index tensor. And the important thing in special relativity, so let's just treat G equals eta. The important thing is that it's conserved. That's called the conservation law of the stress energy tensor. Its divergence is zero in the four-dimensional sense. So if we write that out, so and I'm only going to deal with So for the moment, I'm just going to assume i.e. g equals eta. If we write out those equations, there are four equations here, because four values of beta, and the zero equation, the zero component, reads like this. Okay, I just sum over that index alpha. Alpha can either be zero or I, and I'll take the term with the I over to the right-hand side. And the other equation is just d naught t naught I equals minus dj tj I. Okay, so those are the four equations you get. The first equation will describe energy conservation. Second equation will describe what? Momentum conservation. Okay, so let's see that. So imagine I've got some volume V with a surface S and in space. Okay, so this is just x, y, z. So some volume in space with a surface S, and I integrate this equation over the volume, then I can rewrite this equation as d by dt integral d3x t naught naught on the left-hand side. You see, the point is that t naught naught is a function of t and x. If I integrate over the x, that's acting on the argument x, but it leaves the argument t free. And this d by dt, I can take outside. In fact, if I'm being careful, that really should be d by dct, because x naught is ct. And this partial derivative can be taken outside the integral, because the integral is not over t. The integral is at some fixed value of t. Okay, so that's equal to minus integral d3x divergence of ti0. And then I can use the divergence theorem right, integral of div v dv is integral over the surface ds ti0. Just using ordinary vector calculus. And so what you see, so we have this picture that if I've got some matter inside volume V, and it's doing something, moving around. But as long as the Ti0 is zero on the actual surface, enclosing that volume, then the volume integral will be independent of time. You see, in fact, this I've written as partial, but actually it's an ordinary derivative. Right, that's just d by dt, because it's the ordinary derivative of that integral, which only depends on time. And so if t naught I is 0 on S, then E, which is defined to be integral d3x t naught naught, is conserved. And so from this formula, you can see that T naught I equals the energy flux. Okay, the amount of energy leaving some volume is just the area, just T naught I integrated over the area. And that ds is, of course, a vector which is normal to the area. And you dot that with the energy flux to get the amount of energy leaving the volume. Now I can look at the second equation here. So similarly, d by dt, let's put a c in there, of integral d3x t naught I tx. So that's equal to the integral of the partial derivative with respect to time of t naught I. And that's equal to minus integral d3x dj tji. And that's equal to minus integral dsi t ds j tji. And so what we see from this is that pi equals integral d3x t naught I is conserved if t, this is integrated over the volume v, if t ji equals 0 on S. So this integral is over the volume V, that's integral over the surface S. And so what do we see from that? That actually T0i, and you'll notice I actually used the symmetry properties here, because in this formula, this was Ti0, and over here it was T0i. But those are equal because the tensor is symmetric. So T0i equals Ti0 is the momentum density. Okay, so we just call this the momentum. It's a conserved quantity. And the integral of T naught I is the momentum density. And by the previous formula, that's the same as the energy flux. What's this TJI? TJI is defined to be the stress tensor. That's why this is called a stress energy tensor. And basically, this formula is F equals MA. Okay? Because here's the momentum. So F equals MA is just d by dt of P equals the force. This term is the force. Right? Why does momentum change? It's because there's some forces. Okay, so imagine I've got this volume with stuff in it, and imagine that stuff is pushing on the volume. All right, so let's have our volume, and let's imagine I've got some stuff, some material in here, and let's imagine the material pushes on the wall. Okay, so I'm sitting in this room, and I push on the blackboard. Okay, off I go. I get some momentum. That's what this equation describes. This is the push. You push on the surface of the volume, your momentum changes. Okay, so this is just dp dt equals F. And the force is nothing but the pressure times the area. Okay, Tij will be the stress tensor actually measures the pressure in various directions. So now let's discuss the perfect fluid. So a perfect fluid is some substance which has some intrinsic properties, like an energy density, like a momentum density. But above all, it has a stress energy tensor, which summarizes those. And you could think of this fluid that at every point in space, let's imagine sitting on the fluid. And what are the essential properties of the fluid? Well, at every point in space-time, it will have a four velocity. Okay, so this perfect fluid is comprised, you can think of it as a bunch of particles or elements of the fluid, and each element is following some world line in space-time. And so the fluid element has a four velocity u mu. And in the rest frame of the fluid, okay, so if I imagine just traveling along with this fluid element, then first of all, the four velocity is just 1, 0. Okay, because the spatial components of the velocity really tell you if the particle is moving in that coordinate system. And by definition, if I'm in the rest frame, it's not moving. But u squared is minus 1, so this component has to be 1. Remember, I'm using g equals eta. I'm just doing special relativity. So that's the four velocity of the fluid in its rest frame, or this is also called the co-moving frame. Co-moving means moving along with. Okay, so in the co-moving frame of the fluid, that's the four velocity. Secondly, in this frame, for a perfect fluid, there is no momentum density. Okay, meaning you're with the fluid. So in that frame, the fluid shouldn't have any momentum, and so T naught I equals 0 in that frame. And third, the stresses are isotropic. Okay, so the definition of a perfect fluid is that if I'm sitting in the rest frame of the fluid, there's no momentum flux, there's no momentum flowing around, and the fluid is isotropic in no special direction. That's obviously the simplest kind of fluid you could have. And then just by definition, T naught naught, the energy density in the fluid is just called rho. We just call T naught naught rho. So rho is the value of T naught naught in the rest frame of the fluid. And P is the pressure. P is defined to be the pressure. Okay, so that's the definition of a perfect fluid. And so now the question is, so I've defined this in a particular frame. I've defined all these quantities in one frame, the frame that is locally co-moving with the fluid. The question is, what is the general formula for the stress energy in any frame? Okay, and I'll write down the answer and then prove it to you. So in an arbitrary frame, T mu nu is equal to P plus rho u mu u nu plus P eta mu nu. Okay, so why is that the answer? Well, all we need to do is to check that that's the right answer in this frame. And then because it's a tensor equation, left and right-hand side are tensors, it must be valid in any frame. So let's just check it in this frame. So let us compute, so we just check this in the comoving frame. Okay, so u mu is just 1, 0. So then t 0, 0 is equal to p plus rho. These are both 1s. This is minus 1, minus p, so that's rho. And then t 0 I is equal to 0, because ui is 0 in this frame, and eta 0 I is 0. And Tij, ui is 0, so I just get this term. So I get p delta ij. So it's obviously true in this frame. But then, as I said, it's so therefore it's true in any frame. OK, so that's the stress energy of a perfect fluid. And let me just comment that this u is looks like this. Now, in an arbitrary frame, remember u mu is equal to dt d tau dx d tau, right? So that's equal to u naught, and then u naught v, where v is equal to dx dt. Okay, the coordinate velocity of the point is dx dt. Here I have dx d tau, which is dt d tau dx dt. So I have this formula, and then you can check that u mu u nu eta mu nu equals minus 1 implies that u0 equals 1 over root 1 minus, I think this should be a c. Yeah, that's v over c. And then this is 1 over v squared over c squared, which is gamma. So actually, u mu is equal to gamma, gamma v in any frame, where gamma is the Lorentz factor. Okay, so let's now see what conservation of T alpha beta implies for a perfect fluid. Okay, so I've got to work out d mu of, so d mu of T mu nu is equal to, so I just have to plug into that formula. And what I'll get is d mu p plus rho u mu u nu plus d nu p. OK, so that's partial derivative with respect to nu. And then I've raised the index with the eta. And let's work this out. For nu equals 0, we get d naught p plus rho u naught squared plus di p plus rho u naught ui. U naught ui is just u naught vi, u naught squared vi. And minus dt p. Okay, so I just worked out those three terms. So that equals zero. And then now let's work out for nu equals I. This is d naught p plus rho u naught squared vi. Plus dj p plus rho u naught squared vi vj plus di p equals zero. And so this is kind of looking promising. I have the time derivative of the velocity here. So that's looking like an acceleration. And so what we need to do is to, so this term is a bit messy. You see I've got the divergence of the velocity. I've got some divergence of the velocity here. But I've also got the gradient of this term. But I can actually use this equation to get rid of the nasty term. So let's write this as 1 and 2. So use 1 to remove dj of p plus rho u naught squared v j. And what you end up with is the following, that dv dt plus v dot grad v equals v dot divergence v equals minus dip. Actually, let me write it as a vector, because minus gradient of the pressure plus v dot times dp dt over p plus rho u naught squared. Okay, and this is the relativistic Navier-Stokes equation. Okay, Navier-Stokes equation is just F equals ma for a fluid. And so you see, if the pressure is negligible, compared to the density, and if the velocity is small, then u naught is 1, or close to 1. P is much less than rho, so I can drop it. So then I will get rho times dv dt plus v dot, actually, sorry, I've contracted these indices wrong. This is v dot grad v. Right, that's the convective derivative. In the fluid equations, you get the convective derivative. You can see it from over here. Here's my v, v dot grad. This v contracts with the grad. And so I end up with a v dot grad times v. And the Navier-Stokes equation just reads like this, minus the gradient of the pressure. Okay? And so if v is small compared to c, there probably should be a c in here, v over c, then this term is negligible. And this is the equation which Navier and Stokes used to describe motion of a perfect fluid. Yeah. Perfect fluid doesn't have viscosity. Yeah. Yeah, with no viscosity. Eta equals zero. Viscosity equals zero. I'm not going to discuss viscosity. Okay? Because I'm just dealing with perfect fluids. In fact, Steven Weinberg has a whole chapter on imperfect fluids with viscosity. It's to do with viscosity is essentially a result of the fact that in a fluid, there's a finite scattering length. There's dissipation from the fluid. So the particles scatter, and this results in production of heat and dissipation and so on. Weinberg has a whole chapter on it. There are people who argue that the whole chapter is wrong. It's a controversial topic. The treatment of imperfect fluids in general relativity is something people argue about. But you'll find in general, many topics in general relativity people argue about. It doesn't really mean there's anything to argue about. People are, frequently these arguments are about pedantic issues. Richard Feynman very famously went to a general relativity conference, I think in Brazil. And he wrote a famous letter back to his wife saying, "Remind me to never go to a conference on general relativity again." Because people are obsessed with issues which are completely unimportant. And I'm afraid the field still has slightly that character. You will find a set of people who try to prove various things mathematically, and then they get stuck on various conceptual issues. And this can go on forever. Okay. See, I believe it's very important to define the problem you want to solve. And that is not a question of mathematics or formalism or philosophy. I mean, that's a question of predicting experiments, what you're going to see. And once you lose that focus, you can go round and round in circles for a long time. Okay, so that is the way a perfect fluid works. Notice some things about this equation, kind of interesting. The relativistic Navier-Stokes equation is quite different than the non-relativistic one. The main difference is that pressure comes in here, okay? And so Schütz has this little book, Introduction to General Relativity, which you might, some of you might like. I have a copy with me, this little green book. And he has a little discussion about this. One of the interesting consequences of the appearance of pressure in that term is that you see, when a star collapses, the pressure builds up, and the pressure gradient builds up. And what causes the star to resist gravity is the gradient of the pressure, right? If there was no pressure, all stars would just collapse to make a black hole. So the pressure is stopping them, and this gradient of the pressure is trying to accelerate the particles outwards, and that's what stops the star collapsing. The problem is that for a relativistic fluid, the pressure also comes in here, okay? So as the pressure gets bigger, it actually reduces the effect of this force term, okay, because in the denominator. So the force term is kind of giving less acceleration due to the relativistic correction of a fluid. It's a very, very simple thing, but that P had to be there in special relativity, just has to be there because of special relativity. And that P reduces the effectiveness of the force preventing gravitational collapse. This turns out to be a very important factor, so that when pressures get too high, in fact, the star doesn't resist its collapse. It shrinks and makes a black hole. Okay? So these very, very sort of elementary term that comes into that equation has a very powerful effect. Yeah.
When we take the limit for small, I feel that we don't recover the equation for classical logistics, because the P plus rho in the denominator stays P plus rho.
Yeah, so this is in, I've taken here the limit, P much less than rho.
Okay.
And V much less than C. Okay, so that is the Newtonian limit. So you're absolutely right. P, Newtonian limit requires P much less than rho. And if you think about this just in dimensions, I mean, from ideal gas theory, right, the pressure is 1/3 number density of particles times their mass times V squared, right? Whereas the energy density is the number of particles, their mass times C squared. And so if the microscopic velocities of the particles are much smaller than C, then this is much less than that, okay? But strictly speaking, when we deal with fluids, we don't talk about the microscopic picture. And so you have to specify that independently, P much less than rho. Now, actually, in the handout, if you look on the there's a page called Relativistic Gas. And on that page, I actually start from the Nambu action, right? From the action being the length of the world line. And I go through and derive the stress energy tensor by varying that action. And so in that way, I give you a microscopic derivation of the fluid stress energy for a bunch of particles. Now, I do one thing there, which is deriving the stress energy tensor. I vary the Lagrangian with respect to the metric. And we'll get to that in a moment. So at the right time, you can read that. And that's sort of complementary to this discussion. So again, in the notes, I've given you the action principle for Einstein's theory of gravity, called the Einstein-Hilbert action. That's on page 1, the gravitational action. Maybe I'll talk a little bit about this. I'll leave you to work it through. So this is on the first page. Bunch of definitions. And then the statement is, so this is called the Einstein-Hilbert action. This is the action for general relativity. S for gravity. The action for the metric is 1 over 16 pi g. Times integral root minus g, Ricci scalar, root minus g d4x times the Ricci scalar. Okay, so one can argue that's about the only thing it could be, because it has to involve two derivatives, has to be a scalar. This volume integral is coordinate invariant. The coordinate invariant integral of a scalar is invariant under coordinate transformations. And that's essentially all it could be. There's another term which you could add, which is a constant. Just add a constant. That's also a scalar. this will turn out to be the cosmological constant, or dark energy. Okay, but let's not do that for now. Let's just leave the Einstein action. And then there are a bunch of formulae here, which I won't go through, but I encourage you to convince yourself they're true, that when I vary this action with respect, so S is a functional, S depends on G of X, okay? And when I vary S, this is defined to be S of G plus delta G minus S of G. And basically, we have to differentiate all this stuff with respect to the metric delta G. And I go through the calculation on the next page and give you various results. So I won't do it in class, but let me just point out that the total action is equal to, let me give you the final formula. Delta S is equal to, so when I vary this gravitational action, what I show there is that it's integral root minus G, delta of the metric times minus the Einstein tensor, over 16 pi g. Okay, so that's the important formula, that the variation of the Einstein-Hilbert action is just the integral over space-time of delta g times the Einstein tensor. And so then what we say is, what's the total action for everything? Well, it's S grav plus S matter. There's some action for all the matter fields in the universe, like electromagnetism and particles and so on. And then we see that delta S matter, well, what is delta S matter? Well, by definition, this is root minus G times delta G mu nu. So when I vary the matter action, it will give some variation with respect to the metric. And then just by definition, the coefficient here is called a stress energy tensor. Okay, so this by definition. And then I will also have sort of variations of the matter fields. Variations of the matter field. And so the Einstein equations follow from delta S equals zero for all delta G. Okay, so if I just vary the total action, I get part of this from the Einstein-Hilbert action, I get the Einstein tensor, I get this part from the matter action, and if you set those two things equal, if you set the sum of these two terms to be zero, then I get G mu nu equals 8 pi G T mu nu. And I'm sorry, I haven't been careful with the C's, so there should really be C to the fourth there if I did it properly. I think there's really a C to the fourth in here.
Why do we use the constant A before the Einstein-Hilbert action to be 1 over 16 and not 1 over 8, so we don't have to put it over 1 mean over 2 there?
The action all comes down to the normalization of the action. Okay, so the normalization of the action for the matter is let me see, why do we normalize it the way we do? It'll trace back to the fact that the action for a free particle should be kinetic energy. Okay, so I'm not going to trace it all the way. But this matter action is normalized so that the action for a particle is the kinetic energy. And this then forces us to this normalization for gravity in order to get the Einstein equations. You can take, this is just the definition of Newton's constant. Yeah.
Is there any other good reason why this stress energy tensor should be the variation of the matter action with respect to the metric?
No.
Is it just
well, there is a reason. You see, the way I've derived it, so this is so kind of general and simple, it's amazing, right? That I can take any matter. You see, this derivation is incredibly clever. I could take matter in Minkowski space, and I want to know, what's the stress energy? The easiest way to work it out is replace the Minkowski metric with the G mu nu and vary with respect to G mu nu, get the result, and then set G equals eta again. And that's the stress energy. That's correct. Now, so that's like a really clever trick for getting the stress energy tensor, and it's the best trick we know of. Now, you can ask, well, why does that result in T mu nu being conserved? You know, because the fundamental property of T mu nu is it's conserved. Why does this? And ultimately, there's a theorem called Noether's theorem. All of these conservation laws follow from symmetries. And the point is that the matter action with G in there is invariant under general coordinate transformations. So the whole construction guarantees that your action is has this symmetry under coordinate transformations. And this symmetry is actually enough to ensure that when I do this calculation, I'm guaranteed to get this result. This follows from symmetry. Okay, which ends up what makes this consistent. So I'm not going to derive that, but I'll just tell you this is Noether's theorem. Noether theorem for general coordinate transformations. Okay. Emmy Noether was this absolutely remarkable woman who, I think, in the 1920s realized that conservation laws result from symmetries. And so all of these so-called brilliant men who had dominated physics in the early 20th century missed this, probably the most profound point of all, which is that symmetries result in conservation laws. Okay, so let's now move on to the next topic. I haven't dwelt on the algebra here. Just because it's a pain and there's a lot of... It's only one page of algebra, but every line on that page you will see takes a fair bit of thought, okay? And I do encourage you to spend the time to understand every line at some point in your life on the first two pages, okay? Because the, computing this variation is... Quite. You have to use some clever algebra to do it. If you do it with brute force, you will die. Okay. And by the way, coordinate free notation will not help you one epsilon. Because it's a real calculation. Okay, so what have we done? We've discussed perfect fluids and the stress energy tensor. We're now going to move on to solutions of Einstein's equations. And this will lead us to black holes. And cosmology. Okay, so these are the two most dramatic solutions of the Einstein equations. First of all, it describes these bizarre objects called black holes, which absorb any light which is incident on them, or anything which is incident on them. And the second is that the whole universe is described by Einstein's equations. And neither of these things were anticipated by Einstein. Einstein thought his equations were just would give small corrections to Newton's theory describing the solar system. And that's what he did initially, but then as time went on, he realized this should describe the whole universe. He didn't find the solutions himself. He used the wrong boundary conditions for his equations. He never found the cosmological solutions. That was found by Friedman and then Lemaître and black holes by Schwarzschild. And the kind of full understanding of these solutions continues. So we want to solve Einstein's equations. So the simplest case is to assume spherical symmetry. Vacuum solutions. Okay, so vacuum means there is no matter. So the stress tensor is zero, i.e. T alpha beta equals zero. So just like Maxwell discovered, in effect, vacuum solutions of his equations, if he had no currents or charge density, just solutions for the electromagnetic field, we can discuss solutions of the Einstein equations with no stress energy tensor. And one of them will be a black hole. Others will be gravitational waves, just like Maxwell discovered his waves. So you see, in a sense, Maxwell really did all of this. Okay, Maxwell's work really set the in 1860, really set the stage for everything that followed. Okay, when he solved the theory for electromagnetism and made it relativistic, he was actually preparing for gravity, general relativity, all of these things. So Maxwell's really the person who got all of this going. And all Einstein did is sort of generalize what Maxwell did. In fact, it's even more true. You see, it's true about all, well, okay, you're shaking your head. It's really true. It was all there. Of course, Maxwell didn't realize there was Lorentz invariance in the equation. He didn't realize how profound his discovery was. But you see, it's true of all the forces, because the weak force and the strong force are nothing but generalizations of Maxwell's theory. Maxwell is a U1 gauge theory. The electroweak theory is SU2. And the quantum chromodynamics strong interactions are SU3. Okay, so nobody deserves any prizes for going from U1 to SU2, except they got a prize, okay, to SU3. I mean, really. This is not such a great advance. But that's just to emphasize how important that discovery Maxwell made was. Okay, so now let's try and solve the Einstein equations. So we're just going to solve this equation, right? Looks very easy. Now, in fact, G alpha beta is R alpha beta minus 1/2 G alpha beta R. Okay, but if G alpha beta is 0, I can certainly contract this with R, so multiply with G. So let's work this out. the first term is just r, the second term is minus 2r, and that better be 0, and so this tells you r equals 0. So vacuum solutions of the Einstein equation have 0 Ricci scalar, and so actually we just want to solve this equation. Okay, vacuum solutions of Einstein equations have 0 Ricci tensor. So let's now try and solve those equations. Actually, I've just rubbed off the stress-energy tensor. Maybe I need to make the point that if that's the formula for the stress tensor in Minkowski space, okay, how do I get the stress tensor in a general metric? Just replace the eta with the g. Okay, that's all. Because that's the equivalence principle. Equivalence principle says that if some laws of physics are valid in the absence of gravity, then all I do to put gravity in is replace eta with g. And there can be corrections to that, as we discussed, but they are small for reasons of scale. Okay, so given some metric, g mu nu of t and x, so we imagine that this is a function of four coordinates, how do I impose spherical symmetry? Okay, so there's a very obvious way to think of this, which is spherical symmetry means rotations of the coordinates. So I'm looking for a coordinate system in which rotations act via x prime equals some matrix times x. Okay, that's a rotation matrix. Okay, that would be a matrix in O3, so O transpose O equals 1. So those matrices are parameterized by the Euler angles. You have three possible rotations in three dimensions. And that's how the rotations are going to act. And what I want is that my metric is invariant under those rotations. So that means that ds squared should, the line element, only on rotational invariance. Okay, so t is good. T is rotational invariant. The rotation doesn't act on it at all. dt is also good. Then we can, so how do I make a rotational invariant quantity out of x? Pardon?
The radius.
Modulus, right. So I can calculate modulus of x. Let's call it r, square root of x squared. So that's also rotation invariant. Okay, now let's think of infinitesimal quantities. So something like r dr, which is x dot dx. That's rotation invariant as well, because x will transform like this. So dx is obviously O times dx. O is just a constant matrix here. And then I can have dx squared. But dx squared, we know from spherical symmetry, is just dr squared times plus r squared d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared, right? because I can write x equal to r, and then a vector cos theta sine theta cos phi sine theta sine phi. And if you work this out, this is dx squared plus dy squared plus dz squared, you will get the metric. So this, by the way, is the metric on flat space in spherical polar coordinates. Okay, so our metric can depend on all these quantities, and that's it. There's nothing else you can write down which is invariant under rotations, because essentially the only way to get a rotation invariant is to contract x with itself, to contract a vector with itself. That's the only invariant. And so this is really all you can do. So so we'll write down the general line element, ds squared. And it's going to be minus some function of r and t times dt squared plus some function of r and t times dr squared plus twice e of r and t times dr dt plus I should have put dr here as well. Dr is certainly fine as a rotation invariant quantity. So I've used it in this term. Plus some function of r and t times r squared d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared. Okay, so that is the most general rotational invariant metric, or line element, that I can write down. So I'm going to just end by proving a convenient fact about this line element. You see, the ugly part of it is this one. This is essentially a diagonal metric, but this is an off-diagonal term coupling dr to dt. And the clever part in the argument is to show that you can redefine r and t to get rid of that term. We can remove the dr dt term by redefining the time t as follows. So let us do the following. Set dt prime, so this is my new time coordinate, to equal eta of r and t times c of r and t dt minus e of r and t dr. This eta is called an integrating factor. And you'll see why in a moment. If I hadn't introduced eta, then this equation would actually be inconsistent in general. The eta is necessary to make this equation consistent for the following reason. You see, if t prime of R and T exists. In other words, if that really is a function, T prime of R and T, then I can calculate dt prime from that function, and it's just dt prime dt times dt plus dt prime dr times dr. Okay, remember this is partial derivative, so dt prime dt at fixed r, dt prime dr at fixed t. But if this is true, then we have d2. So you see, identifying these terms, this would be dt prime dt. That's dt prime dt. But the fundamental fact about partial derivatives is they commute. Okay? And so if this function exists, then d2t prime dr dt must equal d2t prime dt dr, because partial derivatives commute. But I can calculate this quantity from here. Dt prime dt is this stuff. Dt prime dr is that. And I can differentiate them, the first with respect to r, the second with respect to t, and they better be equal. Okay, so that implies d by dr of eta c is, let me put the arguments in just to make it. Equals minus d by dt of eta tre rt. I've not been consistent with the order of the arguments, I'm afraid. Here I called it rt. Have I done this anywhere else? I was using rt. Let me just change them all to rt. Okay, so if that function, if t prime exists, then I have to have this equation true. So now we can ask, does eta, is there an eta which solves this equation? Right? Is there an eta of r and t which solves this equation? Okay, so for example, if I'd set e eta equal to 1, that's definitely not a solution of this equation, because c could have been anything, and e could have been anything, and there's no reason why these derivatives should be equal. Okay, so eta is definitely not equal to 1, and that's why I introduced it, to ensure a solution exists. But when you stare at this equation, actually what it is, it's a time evolution equation for eta. You see, if I give you eta, let's draw t and r. And so let's imagine this is time 0, or let's call it time t0. If I give you, so given eta of r at time t0, some initial time, you give me some function eta along here, this equation tells me what the time derivative is. So this equation tells you, so the equation determines dt, eta, dt of eta and r at t0. Okay, so I can just solve this equation for d by dt of eta. And everything here I will know, because I know c at that time, I know e at that time. Well, there are two terms here. There's the eta d by dt of eta, and then there's the d by dt of e. But this is a known function. So I take all the known stuff up to, over to the left-hand side, and I'll get an equation that dt of eta r and t equals some known function involving c, e, eta, and r and t. So that's a time evolution equation. Given eta at one time, you can determine its time derivative. Okay. Now, having solved for its time derivative, you can work out its second derivative. D by dt of this equation will give me the second derivative of eta, which will determine, which will give me on the right-hand side, eta and its first derivative. But I know the first derivative, okay, in terms of eta. So I can work out the third derivative, and the fourth derivative, and the fifth derivative. Any derivative I like, I can determine in terms of eta at the initial time. But if I know all the derivatives of the function, then I know the whole Taylor series, and then I know the whole function. Okay? Yeah.
Why the function is analytic?
That's always the assumption. The assumption is that everything is analytic. Okay, so yes, there is a solution. There is a solution for eta r t. In fact, there are a large number of solutions because I had complete freedom in choosing this function. I could pick this to be anything at one time, and the equation will solve for eta. So why did I do that? Well, the reason I did that is now that I know t prime of r and t exists. And now I can use that to write the metric. So I'll just substitute that equation for dt prime into the metric. Okay, the claim is that ds squared equals minus dt prime squared over eta squared c plus d plus c inverse e squared dr squared plus r squared. Oh, wait a second. Oh, I left out one argument. Just check if I can do it in that order. Yeah, I think I can. So let me leave that f in there. F of r and t, r squared d theta squared plus sine squared theta. Actually, no, I can't do it in that order. I left out one argument. At this point, first thing I would like to do is to define this as r prime squared. Okay? So when you think about it, I'm completely free to redefine my radius coordinate. So it makes sense to try to make this look like flat space. So let's just call that r squared. Okay? The only possible thing that could go wrong is if the eigenvalues of the metric were not minus plus plus plus. But since this piece is separate from those pieces, in order for the metric to be non-singular, this must be positive everywhere. And therefore, there should be no problem in defining r prime to equal that quantity, i.e. r prime equals square root of f times r. Okay, so that was the first step. I just forgot to mention that. When you do that, you see r prime is now square root of f times r. When I have something like dr, I must calculate it from here. So I must solve for r of r prime and t, and then eliminate the dr terms. But when I do that, all I will do is get terms of the same form, right? I'm not going to change anything here. I'll change the actual values of these functions, but I'm just going to get So I'm going to get dr equals something times dr prime plus something times dt. And I'll plug it back in here, and all I'll get is terms of this form. OK? So I do that step first, and then redefine. So then redefine C, D, and E to be these terms, to be the coefficients of dt squared dr prime dt and the r prime squared, right? And then I'll drop the primes. Okay, so I just forgot to mention that step. I can replace that with r squared and then continue as before. And the statement is that this is now the metric. This is r squared. So let's just check the algebra. Dt prime squared gives me an eta squared, which cancels the denominator, the eta squared. So then I'll get, so that is equal to minus 1 over c, eta squared cancels, I get c dt minus e dr squared. And then I have this factor, dr squared plus r squared times this junk. And we've designed things so that this minus e squared dr squared over c exactly cancels that term. Okay, so this will give me minus c dt squared. That's what I get from this term. This term goes away. Then I'll get minus minus gives a plus, so 2e dr dt. And then from here, plus d dr squared plus r squared junk. Okay? So this new metric is exactly what I had before in the new coordinate system. So here's my line element. And the final step is just to rewrite that as minus b of r and t dt. So I'm going to drop the primes again. So I change coordinates, and I drop the primes after changing the coordinates. Dt squared plus a of r and t dr squared plus r squared d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared. So we went through a lot of work just to reduce the number of free functions in the metric to 2. Okay, so any spherically symmetric metric can be described completely in terms of only 2 functions. And so next time we will substitute this into the Einstein equations and solve explicitly for A and B. And that will give us a black hole. Okay. Any questions?
It was on something we did much earlier. Maybe you should have asked then. I don't see why if we have the Ricci scalar equal to zero, the Ricci scalar equal to zero on the top board.
Yes.
Why is it necessary that our alpha beta is zero?
Oh, because the Einstein equation is that G alpha beta is zero. But G alpha beta is R alpha beta minus a half G alpha beta R. So if R is zero,
yes,
then R alpha beta has to be zero.
I thought it was a more general statement.
No. It's just if the Einstein equations are valid in vacuum, then actually R is zero and R alpha beta is zero. They both have to be zero. So you don't need to think about the Einstein tensor anymore. The Ricci tensor is enough in vacuum.
Okay.
We also have to think about if these solutions are dynamically possible or not.
Are they?
Dynamically possible. I mean, the solution might not happen.
Must not.
May not happen.
Yeah, no, that's true. So whenever you solve differential equations, you must worry about boundary conditions. Okay? And so for Einstein's equations, typically we give initial conditions. So typically we imagine a universe with some metric and usually some matter. And then we will evolve them forward in time and see what happens. Now, we're not actually going to do that. We're just trying to find solutions. But you're absolutely right. You can worry, are these physical? If I find some solution, is it physical? And when Schwarzschild first found the solution, it is singular. You see, the solution we'll find is singular. And until 1960, people did not believe these were physical because the solution looked singular. In 1960, Kruskal, who was an undergraduate at the time, Martin Kruskal was an undergraduate, realized how to change coordinates away from these ones into coordinates where Schwarzschild's solution, which was singular at the horizon of the black hole, Kruskal found coordinates in which the solution is not singular. Okay? And so that convinced people, oh, maybe these things are actually real. Nobody had observed a black hole at that point. Okay? So now we had some coordinates in which the horizon of the black hole is not singular. There's still a singularity inside the black hole, but we can't see it. Okay? So then throughout the 60s, people began to wonder, maybe these things are real. And through the 70s, observational evidence began to emerge for black holes. And by now, it's completely overwhelming. So we can see the black hole in the center of our galaxy. In fact, our new faculty member, who's joining us in a week or two, Avery Broderick, he's the first person to actually image the black hole horizon of the black hole in the center of the Milky Way. Okay? So this is a very quickly evolving field. And ultimately, the question of whether these solutions exist is an observational one. But they certainly seem to.
Yeah.